I was covered with dust, and even found pieces of debris between my belt and my coat. We marched back to the village singing, M.A. tilde currency kiss hide, M.A. tilde currency kiss sand, signed day M.A. tilde currency kiss feud, signed mine himatland. We were still the masters, and no one under heaven could judge us. The SS took over the few prisoners who had surrendered before the massacre and loaded them into their trucks, which then drove off down the road that had brought us here. We were ordered to fall in by threes. By the time we reached the village, the crowd that had watched us leave was gone, which was a relief. The SS task force gave each of us a slip of paper to explain the delay in our return to our units. We were advised to rejoin the wrecked train immediately. No one regretted leaving that place, with its miserable memories. Unfortunately, a final spectacle, as depressing as anything we'd seen in the shed, was unfolding just as we marched by. A firing squad was performing its duties. Four consecutive salvos rang out, each one disposing of four partisans. Their bodies were left on the snow, and the squad marched back to the village. Not one of us said a word. At least 100 of our soldiers had been summarily killed in the derailment and the disintegration of some of the cars. An officer spoke to us, briefly about the tragedy we'd just witnessed. The partisans were held responsible for everything that had happened. Also, partisans were not eligible for the consideration due to a man in uniform. The laws of war condemned them to death automatically, without trial. We spent the night on the motionless train. I was able to sleep only fitfully and with difficulty. Each time I closed my eyes, I was caught in a hideous nightmare. A huge stone rose up in front of me, and from beneath it a flood of dark, blackish blood flowed toward my feet, burning them as it touched. The next day was piercingly cold. We joined another train which came to our rescue farther down the line, and settled down to listen to the penetrating clang of the wheels on the rails. We stared out at the tundra, buried under deep snow. From time to time the monotony was broken by a distant horizon marked by pine-covered hills. Once again, the vastness of this countryside, untouched by any human life, filled us with a sense of constraint. The idea of space, the conception of immensity, could not be more perfectly expressed than by this scenery designed for giants. Could anyone possibly control this country? Could we? Could the NKVD? We arrived at Vinnytsia that evening. An air raid alert had disorganized the traffic, and the station was overflowing with soldiers in long winter coats. At that time, the Gross Deutschland Division was partly based in the town, and the military police were able to direct me to its command post. I was surprised by the efficiency of divisional organization. With only the name and number of my company, they were able to give me its precise location. I was horrified to learn that we had returned to the front, and, along with 20 other companies, were occupying a zone some 300 miles from Vinnytsia. I was given a precise district and the number of the sector. I had mentally prepared myself for a reunion with my friends, huddled around some blazing Russian hearth, discussing my cancelled leave and the possibilities of getting it revalidated. Instead, we were destined to meet in some frozen trench, in conditions of misery and danger. This misfortune overwhelmed me with the force of a stupefying blow. I stood, motionless and stunned, in front of the Stabsfeldwebel who had just checked my name on the list. He would have paid me no other attention, but was suddenly struck by something about my appearance. "What's the matter?" he said. "Are you sick?" I was too numb to think of a suitable answer, so I told him the truth. I was just beginning a convalescence leave, Herr Stabsfeldwebel, and it was cancelled at Lublin. "The Fatherland is living through a time of serious trial, young man," he answered after a short pause. "You are not the only one to be deprived of a well-earned rest. The men who have gone through here before you and those coming after you are all in your situation." I was about to remark that this was in fact my official convalescence when he came on the paper from the SS Hauptmann. "I see that you recently distinguished yourself in an encounter with partisans," he said. "My congratulations. I shall include that information in your dossier, and your company commander will undoubtedly promote you. Despite my nervous exhaustion, I smiled for a moment. I am very pleased, Herr Stabsfeldbel, I said in a semi-sincere, semi-official tone. And I am equally pleased for you, he answered, holding out his hand. I left with some 30 others in the same plight as myself, my mind torn by conflicting thoughts and feelings. However, we were sent to spend the night in a warm and comfortable house which had been turned into a military dormitory. There weren't enough beds, but every room was heated, and the floors were thickly carpeted. We all slept well, despite our anxiety about the immediate future. We had all learned to use waiting periods for sleep whenever we could, simply to stop thinking and lapse into unconsciousness. Reflection added nothing to such times except increased awareness of the misery that weighed on the world. Sleep, on the other hand, helped in many ways. It blotted out the present, and revived one's strength. It seemed most unfortunate that one couldn't store up a surplus of its benefits to use in future emergencies when sleep would be impossible. We spent most of that night and the next 24 hours asleep or dozing, interrupting our rest only for meals. During the second night, we were finally dragged from our torpor by a non-com who led us to the trucks which were to take us to our positions. The brutal winter cold fell onto our backs with the shock of a poorly regulated shower. Winter had arrived in full strength, coating everything with a bluish glitter. Roll was called, and we boarded the trucks. Before daybreak, we arrived at a village of huts which had been built by the engineers. We were ordered out of the trucks and offered an ersatz drink which was kept hot through the day in three large kettles. The cold was piercing, and revived all our memories of the previous winter, the shivering mornings, the cold, which became an almost unbearable torture, the impossibility of washing, the lice, and the thousand other elements which made life insupportable. Everything smelled of the war, and every face was stamped with urgent anxiety. Large holes, which suggested air raids, also implied that matters were not entirely under control in this sector. About 50 of us were rejoining units in sectors separated by as much as 40 or 50 miles. We were divided into four groups, each of which was given mail and the supplies requested by particular companies. Then we were shown our approximate routes, and a non-com informed us in a tone of triumph that we would have to cover at least 20 miles. We began our march, through a chain of long snowy valleys. A network of heavy defenses extended for about a half mile around the center we had just left, anti-tank guns, minefields, which we were careful to avoid, and innumerable nests of machine guns. Beyond us, wild, empty country stretched out into infinity, hardened by winter, and favorable to any kind of hostile surprise. As soon as we left the last line of defenses, we knew we were on ground which belonged to whoever was walking across it at any moment, and which could change hands from day to day. The front in this sector was never precisely drawn, but was more like a piece of lace embroidery, with a multitude of recesses which sheltered ambushes, and encounters more or less foreseen, and unpredictable clashes. One of the men in our group was a new recruit, very young and tall and stringy, like a weed that has grown too fast in a spell of damp weather. His enormous gazelle-like eyes stared at the anonymous vastness of the landscape, which he was clearly incapable of absorbing. He was visibly affected by the loss of his native dimensions. The short vistas of the Rhineland had never led him to suspect that such a huge scale was possible. A year ago, I had felt the same way. The cold, which had turned dry after 10 days of snow and cloudy skies, made the landscape into a white screen against which darker objects were startlingly visible. The wind of the preceding days had swept across the snow, piling it up against every barrier, filling in hollows, and leaving brown patches of bare soil in other places, like great stains. As long as we didn't have to make any excessive detours, we preferred to follow the bare patches. Every hour, we stopped for a short rest. 5 or 6 planes flew by to the south. We froze for a minute, trying to discern their purpose, but they vanished over the horizon before we were able to distinguish whether they were Yaks or ME-109s. By lunchtime, we were still unsure of our bearings. The non-com responsible for getting us to our destinations claimed that we were moving in the right direction, but his face and voice betrayed his panic. Country on such a vast scale cannot be trifled with. One can play explorer in the forest of Fontainebleau, but not on the tundra, where one feels too small and trivial for games. The hostile indifference of nature seems so overwhelming it is almost necessary to believe in God. We walked for a long time, and finally came to a line of telegraph poles stuck unevenly into the ground. They were following the edge of a road which we could see was in use, as it was deeply marked by fresh ruts. The non-com decided we should take the road to the south, as the quickest way of finding our units. This seemed odd, as it was clear that we would be proceeding perpendicular to our previous direction. However, no one hesitated. We had long ago learned that it was useless to argue points which had lost all meaning. We also felt heavily oppressed by the prospect of a night in the open, the first of a long series which would require all the patience and endurance we could muster. For a fraction of a second the thought of my wrecked leave flared through my consciousness like a shooting star in the night sky. I swallowed hard, and everything sank back into uniform gray. The weedy young recruit remained speechless. His astonished eyes moved from the snowy steppe to the faces of the experienced veterans we seemed to be. Trusting us as a shepherd trusts the stars, he plodded dutifully on. We suddenly caught sight of a massive object buried in the snow about 500 yards ahead of us. A long gun barrel poked through the white crust, and we realized we were facing a camouflaged tank. Of course, it was one of ours, otherwise we would all have been dead. The Panther was buried up to its turret, and behind it two or three bulges indicated bunkers. Suddenly a fellow appeared on top of the tank, wearing a sheepskin vest over his black tank corps uniform. He jumped down and walked out to meet us, shouting his name. We did the same, according to the custom of the times. He told us that when his tank had broken down he had been ordered to half bury it and turn it into a blockhouse. With considerable difficulty, he and the eight other men with him had carried out the order. Separated from their armored unit by the force of circumstances, they had been standing guard over this vast, empty panorama for 3 weeks now. Once in that time some Russians had come by, but the tank's two SMGs had forced them to pass far to one side. This accident had transformed them into an official surveillance post, and they were due to be relieved in 2 weeks' time. They had been there for 3 weeks already, and admitted that it was difficult to sleep really soundly at night. "Where is the front?" our non-com asked. "More or less everywhere," the other said. "And mostly mobile units. In the evenings, convoys come through on the track. They never have their lights on, and every time it scares us to death. A plane knocked our radio out, so we're completely cut off. It's enough to drive a fellow mad. We're supposed to be rejoining our units," the non-com explained. "Do you think we've still got far to go?" "Well, the front is certainly 5 or 10 miles east of here. But it's very fluid. It's impossible to be exact." We all felt extremely perplexed. "Let's go along that way," our guide said finally. "We're bound to find something." The tank crew watched us go with regret. With darkness, which fell earlier than we had expected, accompanied by a heavy fog, we arrived at the precarious approximation of a front which existed in that sector. A few arbitrarily disposed packs emerged from the darkness, and a sentry, green with terror, shouted, "Where DA?" in a trembling voice. The same terror made our non-com squeak an incomprehensible reply. Our preservation from the guns of our own men could only be laid to a simple collapse of vigilance. A frozen, ill-tempered soldier led us to the company commander. "The Russians come through this way from any direction," he said as we walked along. "It's pretty demoralizing, and unless the front is stabilized again, it'll go on this way, as far as I can see. Anyway, the regiment you're looking for isn't around here." We ran into the company commander, a captain, coming up from a candlelit hole. He looked old and ill. His long overcoat was thrown carelessly over his shoulders, and his chest was covered by a thick, pale scarf which stood out against the grey-green of his uniform. He wore a forage cap instead of a helmet. We snapped to attention out of habit. The officer studied our map, trying to find some helpful directions he might give us. He seemed bewildered. The map included very few details, which made it almost as easy to get lost on paper as it was on the ground. He made some deductions in the light of a pocket flashlight, and decided to send us to the northeast. As the regiments were disposed, ours must be in that direction. This seemed a long way from the orderly procedures of the Grossdeutschland office in Vinnitsa. Despite the exhaustion of their long, painful march on which we had been engaged since dawn, we set off again, into the icy, foggy darkness. 3/4 of an hour later, some fellows in a company buried in that white desert huddled a little closer in their shelter to make room for us. We had to stop, or we might have been lost for good. The acid, almost palpable fog burned our throats and made every effort excessively painful. We managed to fall asleep despite the cold, which, as always, was much harder to bear at the beginning of the season, before our bodies were used to it. Outside, in the trenches, the sentries were stamping up and down to keep from freezing on their feet. The veil of fog wrapped them round completely, cutting them off from everything that lay beyond their parapets. We spent a harassed night of half-sleep. Despite the lamp heaters and the canvas stretched across the mouth of our shelter, the cold, still only relative at the beginning of the season, was severe enough to make us feel half-frozen. The thermometer must have fallen to as low as 15 degrees, and the fog poured in, almost as thick as outdoors. The troops passed the time as best they could, either sunk in sleep despite the discomfort, or playing scat, or writing home with a pen precariously balanced between numbed fingers. The candles, on which they had been ordered to economize as much as possible, were stuck into empty tins which caught the melting wax, prolonging their lives by as much as 4 or 5 times. The memory of those bunkers buried in the wildness of the steppe still haunts my memory, like a legendary tale heard in childhood. The demoralizing dawn cold greeted us as we left the hole. Silently, we resumed our march and our search. Everything was quiet, as if paralyzed by the cold, as dangerous an enemy as the Red Army. For a long time, we walked parallel to a frieze of barbed wire, coated with frost. The fog, which had not yet lifted, clung to the wire in minute drops which froze instantly. Toward the end of the morning, 2/3 of our group at last found their regiment, whose officers were able to tell us the approximate positions of the other 2 regiments we still had to find. More precisely, for the 16 of us still at loose ends, we were looking for 2 regiments and 3 companies. The young recruit and I, for example, belonged to separate companies, and the weather was no help. The inescapable necessity of trial and error added a considerable number of miles to our progress. We grew increasingly angry. How could our instructions have been so vague? Organizational failure of this kind were particularly hard on German troops, who were accustomed to the utmost efficiency. In fact, the centers of responsibility had practically ceased to exist. The extraordinarily tight army organization, which had functioned so superbly in Poland and France and all the smaller countries invaded by the Wehrmacht, was lost in the immensity of Russia, where the front was nearly 1,500 miles long. Our rapidly dwindling transport capability further complicated the situation during the terrible winter, which was to be followed by only one more. Our group of 16 men was made up of 14 fellows belonging to one unit, myself, attached to another, and the tall young recruit, who was looking for still a third. To be exact, he and I belonged to 2 separate companies in the same regiment. Just before dark, the main group of 14 ran into their unit unexpectedly, as had the others. The young fellow and I were left to fend for ourselves on the icy track already packed hard by endless comings and goings. Feverish with anxiety, we pursued our tentative route, passing through a half-deserted hamlet. The few soldiers occupying it, dressed as they pleased, or as they could, stared at us in silence. We felt embarrassed and frightened. According to our instructions, we were to keep on to the northeast. As long as there was any light, we tried to fix reference points on the slightest hollow or hump in the ground, on features more imaginary than real, which we projected onto the infinite monotony. We kept the earthworks and trenches of the front on our right. However, the fog soon reduced the possibilities of navigation to nil. Despite my youth, it seemed that circumstances required me to assert myself. The other fellow was looking at me with wild, questioning eyes. I suggested digging a hole deep enough to cover with our two canvases to make a shelter for the night. This idea terrified my companion, who wanted to keep going. "Our regiment must be quite close now," he said. "You're crazy," I said. "We can't keep on like this. We'll only get completely lost, and then the wolves will eat us."
"Wolves?"
"Yes, wolves. And there are plenty of other things about Russia even worse than that. But they could come after us right here, too. Of course if we're in the open. But once we're under canvas they leave us alone. And then if they do come, we'll shoot them. Well, then it comes to the same thing. And by tomorrow, we won't remember any of the directions. We're following a sort of track, aren't we? We'll keep on with it tomorrow, and that's that. Believe me, it's the best thing to do." I finally persuaded him to do as I said. We had just begun to attack the rock-hard ground with our picks when we heard the sound of an engine. "A truck!" The young fellow shouted. "A truck, you're crazy. Don't you hear the treads?" He stared at me. "A tank? Is it a German tank?" "How the hell would I know? But we're behind our lines, aren't we?"
"Oh, for God's sake."
"Of course. I hope so. People who need long explanations at moments when everything depends on instinct have always irritated me." "What are we going to do?" he asked. "Get the hell off the track, and try to hide in the snow." I was already moving back. The noise had grown terrible. The tank was nearly on top of us, and was still totally invisible. I know of no other experience which twists the guts harder than that. We waited for what seemed an eternity before we perceived a squat silhouette sliding smoothly over the ground. The noise was overwhelming. I stared through the darkness, trying to catch some distinguishing details. Finally, drawn by an inexplicable force, I got up, and moved forward cautiously, leaving my astonished companion to his own devices. After a moment, he joined me, staring at me with anguished, questioning eyes. "It's a tiger, one of ours. We've got to try and catch it. Let's run after it. We have to be careful, though. They might think we're Russians. But if we catch up with them, they could take us along." "Exactly." We began to shout like madmen, running after the tank with some anxiety, but as hard as we could. The noise of its engines drowned our voices, and it passed us by. "Grab your things," I yelled at the recruit. "We've got to gallop behind them. We've got to catch them." We began to run along the ruts left by the treads. Although the tank was moving slowly, it was still going faster than we could run. We were already gasping for breath. I quickly realized that we were never going to catch it, and that we would have to take a chance. I grabbed my Mauser and fired into the fog, into which the tank had almost disappeared. This, of course, was extremely dangerous. The tank crew might think they were being attacked and let us have it with their machine guns. The tank stopped. "They must have heard the shot," we shouted, "Kamerad," as loudly as we could. The engine was idling, and was making much less noise. "We heard someone from the turret, was it D.A.?" We rushed forward, drawing on all our strength. We were now very close. The fellow in the turret must surely have had his finger on the trigger.
"Only two of you?"
he yelled when he could see us. "What the hell are you doing here?"
"We're trying to find our unit, Kamerad. We lost."
"I'm not surprised. We're lost too." We noticed with relief that he was wearing a white helmet stenciled with tiger stripes, which meant that he belonged to the Gross Deutschland. We explained our situation, And they pulled us into the tank. You're both gross Deutschland?
Yes. The interior of the tank, which seemed to be painted with orange lead, was filled with the dim, yellowish light of a metal mechanics lamp which hung from the ceiling. There were two fellows in the turret, and probably a couple more up front. The engine made so much noise that it was almost impossible to talk, but it warmed the air agreeably, and filled it with the smell of hot oil and exhaust. Despite the ample dimensions of the turret, the steering gear and ammunition cases took up so much room it was a squeeze to fit us in. The tank commander was keeping his eyes and ears open, thrusting his head from the turret at closely spaced intervals. He wore a thick winter hat which looked quite Russian. The tank crew told us that they too were looking for their unit. Some engine trouble had held them up for nearly 2 days. Now they were trying to orient themselves by the batteries and companies they passed a dangerous business, because a solitary tank is like a blinded animal. They didn't have a radio, and their group leader seemed to be doing nothing about them. Maybe he had already classified them as missing. They also told us that the new Panzers were coated with a magnetic anti-mine paste, and exterior fire extinguishers. The most dangerous weapon for them was still the rocket launchers which the Russians had perfected after encountering our Panzerfaust. They said that none of the Russian tanks could stand up to our Tigers. In the spring, on the Romanian frontier, we would see the Tigers in action for ourselves. The T-37S and KW-85S discovered the Tigers' superiority for themselves. The hard way. An hour later, the tanks stopped. A signpost, shouted the commander. There must be a camp near here. It had begun to snow large, feathery flakes which clung to every surface. A post bristling with signs loomed unexpectedly out of the darkness. One of the crew brushed the snow off the signs with his gloved hand, and read out the directions. It seemed that the company the young recruit was looking for, along with three or four others, was somewhere to the east. The rest of the regiment was to the northeast, which was the way the tank was headed. The young soldier who was arriving at the front for the first time had to say goodbye, and walk off alone into the darkness. I can still see the expression of terror on his white face. 20 minutes later, we ran into my unit, and the tank crew decided to stop for the night. I jumped down, and went over to a cluster of wretched izbas to ask directions. The long, peaked roofs rose from the ground like large tents. In the command hut, a non-com was sitting at a rough desk made of a couple of boards propped up on boxes, and lit by three candles. As there was no heat, he had thrown a blanket over his coat. He was able to tell me roughly where I could find my company. I found myself moving through a succession of bunkers, foxholes, and trenches, as on my first visit to the front, only these were far more precarious and much slower than the ones on the Don. The engineers, who were spread very thin on the ground in this sector, had done what they could, but most of the work had been left to the picks of the exhausted infantry. Winter had begun in earnest. The ground was frozen hard, and from now on things could only get worse. I kept asking questions, and finally a fellow from a liaison took me to our officer's bunker. The sentry at the entrance inspected me narrowly before pulling back the canvas, astonished to see an ordinary soldier escorted like an officer. Wesredo was not asleep. A short pipe which had gone out jutted from the high collar which hid most of his face. He was bareheaded, and seemed to be studying a map. Two lamp heaters lit the hole, but didn't have much of an effect on the cold. At the back of the dugout, a man was lying on the ground, dead asleep. A lieutenant, sitting on a pack, was also sleeping, with his head in his hands. Captain Wesredo looked up, to see who had come in. I was about to announce myself when the telephone rang, probably some unimportant report. A moment later, I began again. Jeffrey Tesager, Herr Hauptmann. Back from leave, my boy? Not exactly, Herr Hauptmann. My leave was cancelled. Ah. But you're well now? How do you feel? I wanted to tell him how disappointed I was, and how much I still hoped to have at least a few days off. But the words stuck in my throat.
I suddenly felt the full strength of my attachment to all the friends who must have been very nearby, an emotion which struck me as both idiotic and profound. I'm all right, Herr Hauptmann. I can wait until my next leave. Wesridow stood up.